Flooding continues to ravage Western Europe, with Belgians fleeing for higher ground.
Well, I hope it will be all right in the next few days. It's going on raining again.
Also today, Cuba has Latin America's only homegrown COVID vaccines and a population eager to test them.
At some point, the researcher have to say, please stop coming to our institution because we already have the amount of volunteers we need.
And the Tokyo Olympics are 1 week away. For athletes and reporters, COVID is making this experience like none other.
I'm not allowed to go across the street if there's a Starbucks or a grocery store or whatever. I go from the hotel, get clearance past the security guards.
No cappuccino for him. I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Deadly floodwaters are beginning to recede in Western Europe, and we're getting a better look at the extent of the damage. Over the past few days, flash floods have devastated Germany and Belgium. At least 125 people are confirmed dead, with many, many more missing. Homes and streets have been ripped up by the sudden rush of water. Rebecca Rossman begins our coverage from the Belgian city of Liège.
Last night, doors, car tires, and street signs floated in the Meuse River that runs through central Liège. They were swept into the swollen river after flooding destroyed dozens of homes in nearby villages. The water in Liège itself had started to creep into a few streets, and the river was only 4 inches from overflowing its banks yesterday. The city told residents to evacuate or seek higher ground.
This was a heavy surprise, you know.
81-year-old Pierre Foyen, who was born and raised in Liège, tells me standing near the banks of the river that he's never seen anything like this in his life.
Well, I hope it will be all right in the next few days, but I don't know. It's going on raining again, and we're waiting for a peaceful atmosphere.
But meteorologists say relief for this part of Europe may not come for days. A troubling sign for the region, which has been under intense rainfall on and off for over a month. In neighboring Germany, more than 1,300 people are still missing. The village of Schuld, about an hour south of Cologne, was wiped out entirely.
Ich würde sagen, dem witterungsbedingten Umstand nicht allzu wohl.
One resident told the AFP news agency that the situation was a World War II-like emergency. More than 1,000 rescue missions have been carried out in Germany. Thousands remain without electricity or cell service, making it all the more difficult to locate the missing.
Sehr geehrter Herr Präsident, lieber Joe, zuerst einmal herzlichen Dank für die Anteilnahme an den Flutopfern und Betroffenen in Deutschland. Das wissen wir sehr zu schätzen.
Speaking from Washington while on an official's visit, German Chancellor Angela Merkel offered her condolences to the victims of what she described as a catastrophe. Politicians and scientific experts are also asking a bigger question.
What people wonder is it climate change? That's the question that is like in the background.
Fabio D'Andrea is a meteorology professor at the École Normale Supérieure in Paris. He says scientists are still analyzing the data from this month's disaster. But there's no doubt that climate change is fueling more extreme weather events.
Indeed, the prediction for a future climate is there will be an increase in strong rainfall.
More extreme rainfall in shorter periods of time, D'Andrea says, causing dams and riverbanks to burst.
So it's not so much the mean amount of water that falls that change, but it's the part of the rains that are strong. You will have more of those.
Other EU countries, including Italy, France, and Switzerland, have sent in search and rescue teams to help with the aftermath in Belgium and Germany. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has also pledged financial support to help with the cleanup. Many experts say they believe this disaster will push climate change to the forefront of Germany's upcoming elections. Chancellor Merkel will be stepping down in the fall. But standing by the river, surveying the damage in Liège, resident Pierre Foyen wishes this focus on climate change could have come sooner.
We had to start it before, 10 years before, because we knew that in advance, you know, and we didn't react enough in a good way.
There's no stopping disaster anymore, he says with a shrug. The most we can hope for in the future is to find a way to slow it down. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Liège, Belgium.
For another vantage point on all this flooding, we turn to Dieter Gerten. He's a professor of global change climatology and hydrology at Humboldt University in Berlin. He's also a researcher at the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. Dieter, I understand you grew up in a town in Germany that's been affected by the flooding we're seeing. What's going on there and what's your reaction to seeing it?
Well, I was grown up in a small village in the center of these events that have been happening. And that's a village that had occasional floods by thunderstorms in earlier years, but not such a big flood. And the second more important thing is even that this affected a large area, so unprecedented large area where these floods occurred due to very strong rainfall covering a large region in the western part of the country.
What is driving this flooding? Is it that there's just no place for the water to go, or is it the rivers just can't handle the excess rains?
It's a hilly region with villages built, of course, in the valleys, and the water that falls on the mountains there, that of course accumulates sooner or later, in this case very soon and very quickly. So it's a combination of the landscape, the topography, of the very strong rainfall. Towns are built near the rivers. Of course, they could expect some flooding, but not at this scale.
What is the normal rainfall for this time of year, and how does it compare to what this area has experienced?
Well, for the whole month of July, it would be 70 to 80 millimeters, but we have seen in one day over a large area, 100 to 200, sometimes even more. So more than double the amount that usually falls in a month came down in mostly 12 hours.
Do you feel like this kind of flood is a once-in-a-lifetime thing, or do you think climate change is playing a role and they could be more frequent?
I think this particular one is even much more than a once-in-a-lifetime event. People are actually saying it is an event that would happen once in 1,000 years. But doing such statistics is, of course, difficult because we do not have observations going back for such a long time. And these extreme statistics, so single events, they are, of course, hard to deal with in a statistical sense. But yes, according to climate projections for the future, it would be physically totally plausible that such events would happen more frequent over large areas and also get more intense. So that would be expectation for the future for a region like Germany. But I must say, it's not only about the floods we experienced in the past years, also heat waves of enormous intensity, which hasn't been recorded in centuries before, and also droughts. So different extremes are affecting the region in different years and seasons, and that makes it even more complicated.
Dieter, your own job title is interesting. You're professor of global change climatology and hydrology, and you work for an institute for climate impact research. So it sounds like Germany's taking climate change seriously.
Yes, it is. In the science, of course, anyway, so international science community takes it very serious, and there's excellent agreement that climate change is real and that humans are mainly responsible for that. When it comes to the political domain, we might also be set up a bit better than other countries because it's always high on the agenda. But the implementation of measures to curb emissions, that is a slow process.
Dieter Gerten is a professor for global change climatology and hydrology at Humboldt University in Berlin and a researcher at the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. Thanks so much, Dieter.
Thank you as well.
The Summer Olympics are now just 7 days away, and the athletes are making their way to Tokyo. We know this year's events are going to be totally different than anything we've seen before, but as the world's Bianca Hillier reports, even getting to Japan is turning into an Olympic-level challenge.
Gemma Howell is ready to fight. In Tokyo, she'll compete in judo for Great Britain. But dominating on the mat isn't the only thing on her mind these days.
Obviously, because of COVID, we all need to avoid getting COVID. So getting to Tokyo is as important right now as the preparation.
Devin Haru is also feeling the pressure ahead of his flight to Tokyo. And he's not even competing at the Games.
This is the most extraordinary undertaking I've ever had to go through to get to an assignment in my career.
Peru will be covering the Olympics from Tokyo for Canada's CBC News. He and everyone else has had a laundry list of errands to complete before hopping on the plane. Within 4 days of departure, everyone needs to produce 2 negative COVID tests, both from test sites approved by the Japanese government. Then they need to input a ton of personal information onto an app, also from the Japanese government. Haru says it asks for where you live, when you arrive in Tokyo, where you're staying.
Even as specific as what seat you're sitting on the plane going over there.
Swimmer Remedy Rule will be representing the Philippines at the Games. She had all her boxes checked when we spoke earlier this week and actually had taken an extra COVID test just to be safe. Still.
I don't know if I'll fully believe everything is happening until I am on the flight to Tokyo.
That's because a lot can quickly go wrong here. I was supposed to speak with members of the refugee Olympic team before they took off from Doha on Tuesday night, but our interview got canceled at the last minute. According to the International Olympic Committee, an official with the team tested positive. They were immediately isolated from the athletes, but travel has been delayed and the team remains in Doha for now. And tests don't stop once the plane lands. Gemma Howell has heard of fellow athletes waiting through more than 5 hours of processing at the airport.
We've been warned to like bring books, bring games, bring things to watch, bring things to eat. Because obviously after an 11-hour flight, you kind of just want to go find your bed.
The beds, although not COVID-related, are another oddity this year.
The beds are made out of cardboard.
Cardboard. They're part of an effort to produce an environmentally friendly games.
I hope there's a comfy mattress on the cardboard bed.
Athletes won't be confined to that bedroom for any quarantine period, but there will be daily testing. Athletes will travel in bubbles with their teams, while officials and staff, like reporter Devin Haru, will be kept on a tight leash. They have to follow a pre-approved activity plan for 14 days.
I'm not allowed to go across the street if there's a Starbucks or a grocery store or whatever. I go from the hotel, get clearance past the security guards, get on a media shuttle to the venue, walk into the venue, rinse and repeat.
Haru's schedule will include the opening ceremony, but he's one of a select few. Most athletes won't actually walk, but will rather watch from the Olympic Village. Remedy Rule, a first-time Olympian, says that'll be one part of the games she's used to.
I guess I'll just be similar to years past. I'll be cheering or yelling at the screen, watching the athletes go by.
Rule's family will be watching from back home, in the Philippines and in Texas, where she goes to school. Her mom is planning early morning watch parties. Rule says she'll make up for the lack of cheering crowds by envisioning previous races in the Philippines.
The home crowd energy is just very special, so that still gives me chills thinking about like how much support and love I felt from the Philippines community then.
All of these extraordinary measures are, of course, to mitigate the risk of COVID-19 spreading throughout the Olympics and Japan. Reporter Devin Haru says as he flies over, he'll be reconciling the excitement of the games with the rising case count in Tokyo.
We can cheer on these athletes, we can celebrate the games, but we can't be blind to the fact that there are people who are suffering in a country that's still under a state of emergency.
Cases have been rising across the capital over the past month, and Olympic organizers say 26 COVID infections have been linked to the games since July 1st. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Coming up, learning more about art through food. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Please do not touch. That's a warning you'll often hear when wandering the halls of museums. Maite Gomez-Rejon doesn't ascribe to that. She wants you to have a sensory experience when you visit a gallery. In fact, she wants you to taste it. Gomez-Rejon is the founder of Art Bites, where she teaches workshops on the intersection of art, food, and history. Before the pandemic, that meant leading cooking classes in museums. These days, she's hosting classes online, looking to art from across the globe for inspiration. Maite Gomez-Rejon joins us now from Texas. Maite, I'd love to start with the way you pair food with art and history. It's not like you say, here's a still life painting of a pumpkin, so we're going to bake a pumpkin pie. I mean, you approach things in a more thematic and thoughtful way. Give us an example.
Yes, I like to look at a work of art. It could be a portrait, it could be a tapestry, it could be, you know, anything. And I think about the time period it was made in, the part of the world that it was made in, and then I delve into period cookbooks and sort of start reading between the lines of the recipes of the ingredients of the spices used. And that's where I come up with the recipes that we prepare, inspired by the work of art, to really look at the work of art in its context and really paint a picture of the time period when the art was made.
It sounds so interesting and of course, tasty. And I know one of your earliest projects was on Alexander the Great's travel. Give us an example there of what you cooked and what art you were looking at.
Alexander the Great traveled with commanders who kept a detailed record of everything, including everything that they were eating and all of the foods that they were encountering. So when they arrived in, you know, India, they were writing about sugar. They were calling it a sweet salt. They were writing about mangoes. When they were in Persia, they ate a dish of rice with sour cherries. So sort of telling these stories while looking at art from Southeast Asia from the 4th century BC, or looking at reliefs from Persepolis. They had this meal right before they sort of sacked the entire palace. It just makes it real, you know, because oftentimes we go to a museum and we look at a work of art and it's very separate than us, you know, especially when we're looking at antiquities. It's hard to kind of make that connection. But when you bring in these real life stories and then make rice with sour cherries or make some sort of mango, you know, lassi or some sort of sweet mango dish, it's a way to time travel.
Hmm. In the case of the Alexander the Great travels, the class on that, did you at all try to recreate a recipe, or were you using the types of food you were reading about and came up with recipes?
Definitely the type of foods that we were reading about, because there were really, back then, no recipes the way that we think about recipes today. So it was more writing about the herbs, writing about the spices. So I sort of take these stories and come up with a contemporary meal. I'm much more interested in the storytelling, definitely based in the time period. I wouldn't include, say, you know, chocolate as much as I love it back in the 4th century BC in Iran, because there wasn't any chocolate. I stay very close to what was available and what was being used, but the recipes are completely, you know, modern, because I want people to make them. I want them to be delicious, and I want people to have a dinner party or just make them at home and have this association, you know, have a story to tell.
I'm curious whether in your classes, do you find that some of your students stare at works of art and look for food in it and say, can we eat some of that?
Sometimes, especially when we look at, like, you know, the Dutch still lives. I mean, they're so sensual. So there's definitely sometimes you just want to jump in there for sure.
You have an upcoming class on the 17th century Mexican nun, Juana Inez de la Cruz. Can you tell us about her and the dish you'll be preparing with the class?
She is fascinating. She's a nun that lived, you know, 17th century Mexico. She was a published poet in Spain. She was very famous. She had a whole library in her convent. And the earliest Mexican recipes are actually in her hand. She left about 33 recipes. Modern Mexican food really emerged around this time period in convents. I mean, the best ingredients coming into the country on these Manila galleons. Basically, the church got first dibs on everything. So this is where we start seeing dishes like mole, which is sort of the quintessential Mexican dish, emerged in the convents. So we're going to be making a dish called cajeta that's like a dulce de leche. It's like a caramel, but it's made with goat's milk. And just talking about her story and talking about the evolution and the history of Mexican cuisine, which is one of the topics that I'm most interested in, especially around her time.
Art can often feel very intimidating to people, but eating and drinking is something everyone knows how to do. Does combining the two make art feel more accessible?
I think so. I think 100%. I think that oftentimes people walk into a museum and they're big, you can't touch anything. You don't know where to start, what to look for, how to look, like, should I like this? Should I not? Like, it's just, it can be very intimidating. But when you bring in this aspect, right, of food and drink, which is something that is so familiar, it kind of breaks the ice. And it makes art much more accessible because we really think about these objects that we're looking at, and we sort of think about, okay, who was making this? Who was viewing this? And it just becomes much more relatable. You know, these were made by people, for people. So when we put ourselves in the shoes of those people, then it becomes much more real, you know?
You've been doing a lot of classes online, but I understand you have an in-person project coming up about the cultural history of corn. Tell us about
yes.
that.
There's a museum in downtown LA called La Plaza de Cultura y Artes, and they focus on Mexican history. And they're opening up a new space across the street that's a kitchen. It's called La Cocina. And I'll be co-curating an exhibit on the history of corn, talking about myths and gods and goddesses, so going way back to the Mayans and, you know, just really sharing these stories about corn, which is the life force of the Americas, to the plight of the modern farmer in Mexico. So I'm really excited and proud to be part of it.
Maite Gomez-Rejon is the founder of Art Bites, where she teaches workshops on the intersection of cooking, art, and history. Yum. Thanks, Maite.
Thank you so much, Carol.
As the Delta variant deepens the COVID crisis across Indonesia, a group on motorbikes is lending a hand, clearing congested Jakarta streets for ambulances. Check out the photo essay right now at theworld.org. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Israel has been a global leader in beating back the coronavirus, but the virus is creeping back. So Israel is employing what it calls soft suppression.
The Israeli government is acknowledging that the pandemic is here to stay, but that it can be managed with minimal damage to the economy.
We'll tell you how they're trying to do that ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. This month, Cubans took to the streets for the largest anti-government protests in decades. The unprecedented display was fueled in part by ongoing economic hardships on the island. The pandemic has basically wiped out Cuba's tourism industry, which the government heavily relies on for hard currency to buy food imports to feed its people. And then there's the U.S. embargo, which has been in place since 1962. President Trump beefed up sanctions against Cuba during his term, which has made the current economic crisis even worse. We're going to zero in on those sanctions with Ada Ferrer. She's a Cuban-American historian and author of an upcoming book called Cuba, An American History. Ada, the U.S. embargo, it's what the Cuban government blames for almost everything that goes wrong on the island. What was the impact of the embargo on Cuba before Trump's additional sanctions?
As you said, Carol, and thanks for having me, the embargo has been in place since the beginning of the 1960s. It was put in place piecemeal, the first parts of it in 1960 and then formalized in 62. And then it's been hardened many times, most significantly in the early 1990s with the Helms-Burton Act, and then more recently by Donald Trump.
What did the Helms-Burton Act do?
Well, for one thing, it made it impossible for the executive, the president, to end the Cuban embargo, which is unusual because normally it's the executive power that has that power. But in the case of Cuba, it's Congress only Congress can lift it. So that has significantly tied the executive's hand. The next benchmark is clearly Donald Trump's hardening of the embargo for political reasons.
What did President Trump add to the restrictions already in place?
Well, it wasn't so much what he added, it was what he adjusted. And of course, he came to power after Obama and Obama's famous opening to Cuba and the Cuban thaw, which created a lot of hope among the Cuban people for an easing of restrictions and for more opportunities for private businesses and so on. Trump instituted changes like limiting the amount of money that Cuban Americans could send to their relatives on the island. Remittances are a major source of revenue for the Cuban state because it taxes them, it charges fees, but also for many, many Cubans. The other thing that Trump did was to further internationalize or try to internationalize further the U.S. embargo. That was true before. That had been done to various degrees since the beginning, and certainly with Helms-Burton. But Trump, for example, sanctioned companies that transported Venezuelan oil to Cuba. It sanctioned banks that did business with Cuba, and some banks ended up closing the accounts that Cuba held in foreign currency in those banks. So those things also affected the Cuban state.
So As I understand it, most of these Trump-era sanctions were done by executive order. So could President Biden, if he wanted to, simply remove them?
Mm-hmm. And he seemed to indicate during his campaign that he would remove those that most hurt the Cuban people. The limits on remittances, I think, are a clear example of something that hurts the Cuban people. So he could have done that. It's become harder since the protests that began on Sunday, because we've seen all these images of Cuban state's security repressing the protesters. There's beatings, there's all kinds of awful images coming out. And so then it becomes harder for the president to, it becomes more politically risky for the president to ease up in that context.
So what could change if the Trump-era sanctions were lifted?
Right now, people are having a hard time finding food. They're having a hard time finding medicine, basic medicines like painkillers and aspirin. So being able to send those or money to buy those or to send those would help. The Cuban president announced a couple days ago that he would lift limits on passengers entering with those products, and he would eliminate taxes on them. This is something that opposition figures have been asking for almost since the beginning of the pandemic, and he said it was impossible. Now, with everything going on, he's allowed that. So clearly, the Cuban state also knows that giving people greater access to those will be a huge relief.
Ada Ferrer is a Cuban-American historian and author of an upcoming book called Cuba, an American History. She's been speaking to us from New York. Thanks a lot, Ada.
Thank you.
While Cubans are facing shortages of food and electricity, the Caribbean island remains a world leader in medicine. It's quickly developed its own promising COVID vaccines. But as the world's Alana Gordon reports, the country's strong medical reputation may be adding to the street-level frustration of Cubans.
Eduardo Ortega Delgado says he's feeling super happy.
Me siento muy contento. Me siento más seguro. Me siento más confiado.
I feel more secure and more confident, he tells me. Delgado is 73 years old. He's a professor of plant physiology at the University of Havana. He's happy because
hoy, hace dos semanas que yo recibí la dosis tres, la dosis número tres.
2 weeks ago, he received the third and final dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. Yes, three doses.
No tuve absolutamente ninguna reacción. Cero reacción. Nada.
No side effects, just some minor pain in the arm after the final dose. This isn't just any COVID-19 shot. It's one that was developed in Cuba.
Yo recibí la vacuna Abdala.
It's called Abdala, a reference to a poem by Cuban revolutionary José Martí. Earlier this month, the Cuban government granted Abdala emergency approval, making Cuba the first place to approve its own homegrown vaccine in all of Latin America. Scientists also recently announced that another vaccine is on its way, Soberana, or Sovereign. They reported that efficacy for both vaccines is above 90%. Scientists and global health leaders around the world are paying attention.
Latin America and the Caribbean, we are a very vulnerable region.
Dr. Jarbas Barbosa is assistant director of the Pan American Health Organization. He says the region needs more options.
It's very important, this development of vaccines in Cuba.
It's quite encouraging. They just add to the arsenal.
Dr. Gary Kobinger is a renowned infectious disease specialist at the University of Laval in Canada, a country he notes that has not succeeded in developing a COVID-19 vaccine. He says Cuba's vaccines use something called conjugated and subunit proteins.
What's interesting with those two vaccines is the fact that they're using what we would characterize as more conventional and well-known vaccine strategies.
Kobinger says these kinds of vaccines have less side effects. They're easy to make and store, but they often require more doses to induce a strong response. Scientists want to see published data on the trials, not just results given in presentations and press updates, to really understand their effectiveness. As for Cubans,
people want to be vaccinated as soon as possible.
Amilcar Perez Riverol is a Cuban molecular biologist at the University of Sao Paulo in Brazil. He says his colleagues in Cuba have been overwhelmed with enthusiasm from the general public.
At some point, the researcher have to say, okay, please stop coming to our institution, because we already have the amount of volunteers, the amount of participants we need for the clinical trials.
Vaccine hesitancy is not a thing in Cuba, says Daniel Rodriguez of Brown University. He specializes in the history of medicine and politics in Cuba.
A major piece of the Cuban Revolution since 1959 is Cuba's increasing medical excellence. You know, the idea that Cuba has an excellent public health system, is able to protect its citizens, and that it's the government's responsibility to protect the Cuban people.
Even before the revolution, Cuban sovereignty centered on its ability to care for its citizens.
It was actually the first country in the world that had a ministry of public health, like a cabinet-level ministry dedicated to preserving the health of the people.
Cuba may be a low-resource country, but it has a strong history of providing healthcare and developing safe and effective vaccines. It manufactures and exports them, too. So when COVID-19 hit, expectations were high. The country stood out for its strong response early on. The homegrown vaccines generated excitement. Now, Rodriguez says, the pandemic is challenging the government's ability to protect its citizens.
Just in the past few weeks, the rollout of the vaccines has not kept pace, and the rollout of the sort of public health vigilance has not kept pace with the spreading pandemic, which has slipped out of the grasp of the Cuban government.
Cuba is now reporting its biggest rise in cases. Rodriguez says this was a turning point for many people.
You really saw a pile of kindling on the ground that was lit.
Cuba is racing to catch up with COVID spread. About a quarter of the population has received at least one dose of a vaccine. Getting the needed raw materials has been a struggle. But the government aims to have the country fully vaccinated by the end of the year. That would be a huge success compared to the rest of Latin America. But it's not clear whether that'll be enough for Cubans. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
Israel has a new catchphrase to describe its latest coronavirus strategy, soft suppression. When it comes to the pandemic, it seems Israel has been way out in front of the rest of the world on vaccination efforts, then easing up on lockdowns and other restrictions. But now with the Delta variant, the Israeli government says it's time to reset things a bit. Reporter Ariel Osserant joins me from Tel Aviv to explain. So Prime Minister Naftali Bennett is talking about a soft suppression. What does that phrase mean?
Israel just recorded a four-month high in new cases after hitting zero cases just a few weeks ago. But we're talking about fairly low numbers compared to other places in the world. 850 new cases were reported today. But due to the high vaccination rate in Israel, Carol, we're seeing very low numbers of serious cases of illness. And that's a major difference from previous waves. So in this soft suppression strategy, as Prime Minister Bennett puts it, the Israeli government is acknowledging that the pandemic is here to stay, but that it can be managed with minimal damage to the economy.
So for Israeli citizens, then, how will soft suppression affect them?
It's primarily bringing back the requirement to show a vaccination certificate or a negative COVID test if you're not vaccinated whenever you enter restaurants, bars. But we're not yet talking about limiting numbers of people in venues. However, this strategy still hasn't been approved by the government. So far, what has been brought back immediately is indoor mask wearing. Health officials in Israel are largely in favor of this plan. I spoke with Professor Gili Regev about this. She's the director of the infectious disease unit at the Sheba Medical Center, Israel's largest hospital. She said that this is a well-balanced strategy, but that it won't work without enough rapid testing.
I would put them all in the pharmacies so that people can go and just know if they're safe to have, you know, the family for dinner, and the grandmother can't see her grandchild despite the fact that he's not vaccinated because she can check him when he enters the house.
Of course, the best prevention we know against COVID is to get vaccinated. What is Israel's vaccination program like right now?
So far, nearly 60% of the population have received both doses, and people ages 50 and above are nearly 90% fully vaccinated. But other figures in Israel have shown that the efficacy of preventing transmission, meaning the chances of you getting the virus even though you are vaccinated, is at 65%. That's much lower than numbers that Pfizer initially reported. But these aren't peer-reviewed reports yet. These are just initial numbers coming out from the health system. But that is an indicator that that has gone down. Having said that, we're still seeing 93% efficacy in preventing severe illness. And that's the more important number for decision makers in Israel. And there are also talks perhaps of vaccinating children under 12, as well as giving a third booster dose to the immunocompromised populations, as the number of cases in Israel are still growing. Here's Professor Regev again.
it is increasing, and I expect it to continue to increase, but I think it's going to increase much slower. Therefore, we have time to decide if we see that it's really increasing in the very elderly. Maybe that's when the decision will be to give a third boost to those older population.
Reporter Ariel Osaran in Tel Aviv, thanks so much for the latest.
Thanks, Carol.
Danish Siddiqui, Peter DeVries, Lexo Lashkarava, names you likely don't recognize. All three were journalists, and all three recently died because of their work. Journalists today are increasingly facing life-threatening dangers across the planet, including here in the U.S. Joining me now is Pauline Adès-Mavel. She's a spokesperson for Reporters Sans Frontières, or Reporters Without Borders. First of all, Pauline, if you would, let's talk about some of these cases. Just today, we learned of the death of Danish Siddiqui. Who was he and how did he die?
The journalist was an Indian Pulitzer winner. He was very experienced, and unfortunately, he was photographing some report in Afghanistan in a zone where we consider that journalists are extremely threatened right now, especially given the coming withdrawal of U.S. forces in the region. It seems that the attack came in two parts. He was first wounded, and then when he was healed, he was attacked again by some Taliban people and died. And we know that not having the foreign forces on the ground will expose them more. So we fear that, like Danish Siddiqui, others will probably be exposed to more danger.
It's interesting. Danish Siddiqui was in a war zone, but many journalists are dying in places that are not at war. Describe other circumstances where journalists may find themselves in grave danger.
Well, unfortunately, we deplore 50 murders of journalists throughout the world each year. And now the number of journalists killed in countries at peace is bigger than the number of journalists killed in countries at war, which says a lot about the kind of difficulties journalists face. Mexico is, for example, one of the countries which exposes the journalists the more. Each year, we have to deplore the deaths of 10 journalists, sometimes a little less. All those who investigate the crime networks, the drug networks, the corruption between the state and some criminal networks are very exposed, and unfortunately, one after the other, they lose their lives.
It's interesting you mentioned Mexico, which has long had a really horrible problem of journalists being murdered. But one of the recent murders of Peter DeVries in the Netherlands has a really, you know, high level of press freedom. It's not a country you associate with the murders of journalists. How surprising is that?
Well, it is on the one hand surprising and not surprising. Peter DeVries was a very experienced journalist. He has been investigating the crime network for the past 40 years. Even though the Netherlands are a country where journalists can exercise their work in good condition, some journalists covering the crime networks are very exposed. All those who investigate the criminal networks in general, in Italy, in Greece, in Eastern Europe, have been exposed to extremely high pressures and sometimes assassination.
Overall, though, has it become more dangerous to be a reporter over the past 5 to 10 years?
It has. We consider that being an investigative journalist is probably now the most difficult job to do as a journalist. Last year, we published a new report about environmental journalists, and those are exposed too. So yes, investigative journalists for sure are more and more exposed, but there is also a good response they can send to those who threaten them. You kill me, but you don't kill the message, because it's shared with others. And we will see in the future whether those recently killed, such as the Ries in the Netherlands, has been able to give part of his investigation to others.
Pauline Adès-Mavel is a spokesperson with Reporters Without Borders. She's been talking with us about some of the life-threatening dangers that journalists are facing today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Across the globe, religion and faith play a role not only in daily life, but also in politics. Consider the African nation of Sudan. It's in the middle of a major transition from an autocratic Islamic state to a more democratic one. The World's Africa correspondent, Halima Gikandi, recently traveled there to report on some of those changes. It's part of our ongoing series called Sacred Nation, a reporting project from The World about the intersection of religion and nationalism around the globe.
Hello, my name is Halima Gikandi, and I'm the Africa correspondent for the World Radio Program. And I'm here in Khartoum, the capital of Sudan, a country that for the past 2 years has gone through enormous political and social changes. In 2019, Sudanese people from across the country took to the streets, calling for the resignation of President Omar al-Bashir, who led the country with an iron fist for more than 30 years. He pushed a strict Islamic and Arab version of a country that is very diverse, both religiously and ethnically. And for many protesters, they went to the streets calling for a change for the system. That said, religion remains a very sensitive issue here in Sudan. So I'm here to report about the different debates about what the role of religion does and should play in Sudan.
The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi begins her series of reports on Monday here on The World. We want to send you into the weekend with music and a connection The World's Marco Werman made with one musician in particular. Here's Marco.
A few weeks ago, I got a postcard in the mail, an actual postcard with a stamp. It read, "Hello, Marco. I have a new record coming out. I'd love for you to hear it. Best, Rodrigo Amarante." If you know this LA transplant from Brazil and his music, that's all the coaxing it took.
You know, I have friends that we actually send letters and postcards to each other, and it's a very sweet thing in these times of virtual interactions. So why not express it, this genuine wish in handwriting, right? I would like for you to hear my record.
That record is called Drama. This is Rodrigo Amarante's second solo album, which does not accurately reflect the 25-plus years he's been making music professionally, from his collaborations with the psych folky Devendra Banhart, or his time in the supergroup he formed with Fabrizio Moretti of The Strokes. And then there was Amarante's Brazilian rock band in the 90s, Los Hermanos. So half the songs on Drama are in English, about half are in Portuguese, and linguistically anyway, those are kind of the contours of your own life story. Brazil to Los Angeles, and in between a lot of work and different iterations, including your song Tuyo, which is the theme to the series Narcos, a Netflix drama about Colombia's drug cartels. Soy el fuego que arde tu piel. A lot of people got hip to you thanks to your song showing up in Narcos, but that just scrapes the surface of Rodrigo Amarante. Was there a moment for you as an artist in the past 25 years that you've been making music that has been the most impactful for you?
I could say the most impactful was when I was in London and met Devendra Banhart, because that first conversation we had led him to ask me to come to the States to record with him. Which led Fab Moretti to realize I was here and ask me to write songs with him. And so it was the sail that was put up and caught that wind, which led me to kind of experiment in this whole other path. Of course, the song I wrote for Narcos was, the outcome was great. I had no idea, I just had a script and had to write a song for it, which is something I actually always wanted to do, serve someone else's purpose and try to expand or to understand why that story is being told and what I can do to expand it. And so that was, you know, in the eye of the public, an important moment. But then again, you know, when I was 25, I was answering questions whether it bothered me that I had a number one hit and that would always be remembered by that number one hit, you know? Mm-hmm. And so even though I've been doing this for a little while, I'm the ever emerging artist. I have a white beard, but I'm still featured in the up and coming section.
Talk to me a bit about the song Tango, which has just one of the most simple, beautiful videos I've seen in a while. It's in black and white and shows this lovely elderly couple dancing a very slow tango.
Yeah, that was one other lucky moment. You know, I've always thought there was something quite interesting and rich in partner dancing because, you know, the man is supposed to lead and the woman follows traditionally, right? And I've always saw that as that's interesting as a metaphor for relationships, you know. But anyway, the video, when I found this couple, it was one of those things. It just like the first couple I saw.
Tell me about them. Where did you find them?
So they run a dance studio here in LA called the Tango Room. Angel is a true porteño from Buenos Aires. And Julie is Mexican-American. And they've been together for many, many years. And
it's also just a beautiful expression about aging.
Yeah. I mean, I feel that maybe it's just in LA, but in America, I see less mingling between older people and younger people, you know, in bars particularly. In Europe and South America, it's a lot more mixed. And I do miss that. It's kind of a shame that we're, you know, young people or all kinds of people aren't mingling with the old ones. I don't know why that is, but it is. And so, in a way, this is me celebrating the people I want to be surrounded by. And since I've discovered the Tango Room, I go back there, and over there, it's a mix. Every color, every race, it's in every age. It's really great.
Well, if it helps, your song makes me want to mingle and dance with everyone all over again.
Yeah, that's nice.
Musician Rodrigo Amarante speaking with my colleague Marco Werman. And I'm Carol Hills saying goodbye for the week. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. Have a groovy weekend.